This is the Peace and Social Justice Program on KZFR. I'm Stephen Chudy, sitting in for Chris Nelson. That was Dona Nobis Pacem. It's a composition by Vaughn Williams, sung by the Ohio State University Choir. I have a two-part program for you today with a strong international flair. First, I'll be talking with Chico and Gail Kimball. Her research into how young people all over the world view and are acting on social issues. And then in the second hour, I'll be interviewing Pamina Fierchow of Brandeis University, who's currently in Italy, and Tiffany Ferry of King's College London, who is currently in Spain, about their work helping people in Colombia see and photograph examples of peace and justice in their communities. The Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with Century 21 Select, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with kind, quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook. And we're supported by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. And a reminder that you're listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And here is my interview, pre-recorded, with Gail Kimball. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Gail Kimball to the Peace and Social Justice Program. You know her, many of you do, from her monthly program, Ask Dr. Gail, on Thursdays on KZFR. Gail has a PhD in religious studies from the University of California at Santa Barbara. She was the first women's studies coordinator at California State University, Chico. She's the author of 20 books, and we'll be talking about several of those today. At my end, this interview really began almost a decade ago. Gail arranged a trip for a small group of Chicoans to northern India. Susan Chudy and I were on that trip along with a wonderful woman from Canada. And we had a great tour guide, Dalbir Singh, with whom we've remained in contact. Susan and I interviewed him just recently on our Ecotopia program. There, she was interviewing young people. While we were off partying and sightseeing, she was meeting with school kids, asking them questions about what they were doing. And that approach has led to several of her books, including ones I'd like to ask her about today, Climate Girls Saving the World, How Global Youth Values Will Transform Our Future, and Brave, the Young Women's Global Revolution. So after that introduction, welcome Gail Kimball.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Steve. I just want to say that it became a joke in India because our guide, who's open to new people right now, I must say, would say, I see global youth. And then we'd find some teenagers on the street near a school, and we'd go up and he'd introduce, this is Dr. Gail Kimball. And we'd have a nice conversation. So it became kind of a joke. It was fun.
He was great, too. And he struggled through COVID. Business was down, but he's recovering now and is eager to take clients. We could recommend him without qualification. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, if you're looking for time in India. We were northern India for the most part, and I still have the bottom half of the country that I would like to see one of these days. But your books with interviews with young people cover a rich variety of topics. Please tell us how you got started on that whole project and a little more about the full dimensions of what you've been doing over the past 10, maybe more years.
Well, all my books, I realized that I didn't set this out with intention, but they've all been about representing unheard voices. So I've done books on egalitarian couples, women's culture, and then these youth books, because I did a book called Ageism and Youth Studies, because I was really surprised to find out that even youth studies books, scholars, they didn't talk to youth. And I was stunned. They would maybe have questionnaires, how much tobacco do you smoke, you know, do you engage in sexual intercourse, but they didn't really interview youth. So I felt like this leaves out an understanding of what's really going on. An example of that is there's increasing rates of anxiety and depression among young people around the world and in the U.S. So a scholar like Jean Twenge at UC San Diego says it's because of cell phone, it's because of the internet. People feel anxious because other people look better or more popular on social media. And she thinks that's the main thing, because it's based on her large surveys of like college fresh persons and that kind of thing. But when you talk to youth, I think it's much bigger than that. It's that they feel so much pressure. And all the teenagers that I've talked to don't get to bed before midnight at the earliest because they're doing activities after school. Maybe a third of American teens are working after school. They have huge homework loads if they want to get into a good college and show that they've taken advanced placement courses. So I think they're anxious, not so much because of social media, but because of the pressures to succeed in such a competitive, difficult society as we have now.
I'll let you continue, particularly about the pressure to get into to college. While people are on the one hand doubting the value of college education, there's this enormous pressure to get it not only into college but into the old guard prestige schools like Stanford, Michigan, Yale, Harvard, which in turn leaves those institutions all too free to continue in outmoded traditions and kind of classical education that doesn't necessarily help people nowadays. But I digress. Please continue where you are.
So whenever I travel, which is lucky being a teacher, you always have summers to explore the world. I would visit schools, just hop in and start interviewing. And over the course of those kind of travels and contacts with teachers who came like to Chico State for a summer program from around the world, I acquired about 80 teachers who gave my 12 questionnaire to their students. And the reason that I can criticize other people's questionnaires is because they're multiple choice and none of my questions are multiple choice. Mm-hmm. So it gave them options to really say what they want to think. And so I ended up surveying over 4,000 young people from 88 countries. And that resulted in the book you mentioned about youth values, ageism and youth studies, Brave, which is a 2-volume book about young women's activism and issues. And I think one of the most interesting findings from those set, which were Gen Y millennials, and now I've done more recent work with Gen Z, is that they're really altruistic. People think of young people as selfish, narcissistic, just concerned about their own identity formation. But when I asked them, what are your career choices? The top ones, all but four, were altruistic. Medical professional, business, not altruistic. Teacher, do good. Social work, counseling. Those were the top. And then when I asked them about what this was a great question, I must say. If you could ask a question of the wisest person on the planet, what would you ask her or him? And those answers were altruistic. They said, I would ask, how can I do good works, make the world better? Some said, how can I achieve my personal goals? But a lot said, how can I help my family, my country? How can I best worship God? And Muslim students were more likely to mention devotion to God. And then another interesting finding, I think, from those 4,000 surveys and interviews was that there weren't distinct gender differences. So there were very few differences between boys and girls in terms of what they said. I divided them by region, and I divided them by kids and teenagers. And there were differences between kids and teenagers that you would expect. Like the kids were more concrete. They wouldn't ask what happens after death, which surprised me how many questions there were about that. What's the afterlife? Is there a heaven? The kids were more likely to say, can I fly? How big is the universe? How did the earth start? They asked more concrete, specific, physical kind of questions. And then the teens were more capable of abstract, philosophical kind of questions. So I think those were the two findings that jumped out at me, is that no gender differences of importance. Of course, differences between the thinking of kids and teens. And then the third one would be that the differences between young people today because of internet culture is not what country they live in, but rather they're urban or rural. And you've traveled a lot. Maybe you can back me up. It's the urban kids around the world have a kind of common culture. I have pictures in the book of like a boy from Rio de Janeiro, and you can't tell where he's from. He's holding a skateboard. He's got on baggy pants. He's got on a T-shirt with some kind of logo in English, some kind of brand name thing. So but the rural kids, totally different story. Many of them don't have contact with the internet. They don't have access to cell phones, or maybe just the family does, or just the village does. Is that your experience as well?
I don't have a lot of experience, so I just want to follow up. So your sense is that the internet, despite the problem you mentioned earlier, the people attributing depression to the cell phone, it's also that the internet is opening up life for the urban kids, gives them a more homogeneous view of the world. I would
absolutely
certainly support that. It's the rural kids that I don't know very well. One of the
right
as about the I was interested in your comment that the boys and girls values are more homogeneous. For a long time, we've thought, boys are raised to be rowdies, toughs, and so forth. And there's been appropriate praise for women's values, and I wish that we could move the world closer toward the kinds of values that women espouse. How do you think the boys are moving in their values? Where are they getting the values that you found were somewhat similar to what the young women were saying?
I have a couple of thoughts. One is that women politicians around the world are, in fact, shown to be more concerned about, family leave and childcare and those kind of services that make life more doable. So that's a fact that women legislators are more concerned about those kind of issues, probably partly because they experience them more. You know, they have a double job of managing the home and earning money and being legislators or whatever. And then what I found, though, is that I wrote this book that you mentioned, Climate Girls Saving Our World. And the girls, the 54 girls that I interviewed, said that they think there still are gender differences. And this is one of the most recent books. So this is very recent. And the gender differences, I think you'll find interesting. What they said is girls are more willing to be weird, to be the climate activist weird girl who's hugging trees or whatever. And they felt like the boys in high school, not like men in their 20s, but teen boys are much more reluctant to take a stand on an environmental issue that's seen as avant-garde or weird is the word that they use.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm thinking of like Black Lives Matter has been led by Black women, especially queer Black women. So that's been the most active recent youth movement in the last few years, since like 2013, 2014. But another really recent youth-led social movement that we hear a lot about today is the Parkland students in Florida, who 2014 Valentine's Day had that huge slaughter. The young, angry young man, our typical shooter, angry young man, came into school and just mowed down teachers and students. Yeah. So they, most of their leaders are young men, like David Hogue is a person you hear a lot about who made it into Harvard. But there was a young woman, Miss Gonzalez, who got a lot of publicity, made a very emotional speech that got a lot of coverage. So I think when young men and young women are touched by a tragedy, a trauma that they experience, it doesn't matter their gender. So they care. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the most active youth movements today are Black Lives Matter, gun control, Hispanics, Latinos, Latinx fighting for DACA have been really active. And now I'm sure I haven't really heard an upswelling yet, but there's going to be, I'm sure, a young feminist uprising against all the denial of access to abortion. That's going to be the next big trend movement.
Susan and I interviewed about Climate Girls Saving Our World a couple of years ago. I wonder if you could give listeners an example or several of the kinds of projects these kids were launching. I was very impressed with how they're implementing their activism.
The contemporary youth movement since the global climate environmental movement, I think you can kind of trace that back to the big event against capitalism, neoliberalism, was in Seattle. The big uprising
the
there,
World Trade. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, against the World Trade Meeting and that kind of thing. So that was a big one. But since 2011, their tactic has been a new one, which is internet hashtag activism, which we've mentioned, which allows for support, information sharing around the world. So they learn, okay, if police tanks are coming at you, spray paint the windows so they can't see out. If they tear gas you, use milk or water. And those kind of tactics for how you deal with police violence are spread around the world and used around the world. And the idea started in Tahrir Square in Cairo in 2011. And by the way, I was there and interviewed some young people, young men and a young village woman who came up from the south of Egypt. She cared so much about it. And those videos and all the others are on my YouTube channel. So if people are interested in hearing the actual voices of youth, just go to search Gail Kimball Youth YouTube and you'll see them. And I also have lots of photos on my Facebook page of Global Youth and a lot of articles on a WordPress Global Youth blog site. So the new thing that they've done is these long-term occupations. Like in the U.S., we had Occupy Wall Street. And so before there would be large demonstrations, but they didn't camp out. So these tent cities are a new tactic that youth led. And what they tried to do was not take over government, but to be prefigurative. to show a new way of being. It's democratic. And this has been a double-edged sword because they tried very hard not to have stars, identifiable media leaders. They wanted to be non-hierarchical, have flat organizing structures, achieve decisions by consensus. But the sad thing is, even in Tunisia, which was the bright light of the move towards democracy after the rebellion against and ousting the dictators, which they succeeded in doing, even Tunisia now has a takeover by a strong man. So I think the goal of non-hierarchy, consensus decision-making, real democracy, everybody's voice is heard, is a nice ideal, but it didn't work. It hasn't worked anywhere, really, in terms of bringing the structural democracy that they would have liked to have seen.
I want to get you to elaborate on that, or maybe qualify a little more. When you say it hasn't worked, it would be it hasn't worked because the traditional forces were more powerful than consensus building and the youth movement. Does that mean one should abandon those strategies of consensus, the kind of new age is the wrong word, the emerging view of how to get things done?
I think that we can learn from the pendulum swing, and maybe the pendulum went too far towards we don't want any leaders, structure, hierarchy. Well, a long time ago in the 60s, a feminist named Jo Friedman wrote a classic article called The Tyranny of Structurelessness. And she said to pretend there's no structure doesn't work because there is. An unspoken, maybe a knowledge structure of people who have more time or more skills or more money or more authority or whatever, there does tend to be a hierarchy. So I think that the pendulum went too far in terms of consensus and too far away from we need a structure, we need a plan, we need a strategy. And I think what you hear in organizing now is that you have to have a plan, a strategy, long-term goals. You can't just do we love you and this is we're all black or we're all feminists or whatever in identity politics. Identity politics isn't enough to make real social change. And what they want to change is neoliberal capitalism that brings about inequality. And that was the slogan, we're the 99%, we're not the 1%. We want 99% to have power. So there has to be kind of a melding of what makes the military work, which is planning, structures, strategy, and real democracy where everyone's voice is considered. And personally, I don't like long meetings where everyone is allowed to talk and ramble on and monologue and yeah, whatever. Yeah. So I don't like that. I personally like to have a meeting where there's goals and time frameworks. I was involved in a feminist men's group called National Organization of Men Against Sexism, and they operated their meetings very effectively by having that kind of structure, but they also had people check in about their emotional feeling and do evaluation at the end and that kind of thing. So, no, I'm not giving up hope, but I think that it went too far. There needs to be a melding.
We've obviously gotten to your book, Resist: Goals and Tactics for Change Makers. You've hinted at a couple of them. We need strategies, structures, and so forth. Could you talk a little bit about that book? What are some of the kinds of tactics that you recommend? And what do you suggest? We obviously, you're suggesting be cautious about consensus building or loosey-goosey meetings with nobody in charge. But let's get into some of the tactics and strategies that you think are demonstrably working and can work for the future.
Well, I think it's important not to just have theory, but to have role models, to have examples. And when you look around the world for the most egalitarian systems, I think it's fair to say it's the Scandinavian countries. And the Scandinavian countries make a point to not have very rich or very poor people. And they are committed to providing free health care, good child care, elder care, college tuition. You don't pay college tuition. So they legislate and are willing to pay taxes for those high taxes for those kind of social programs. And it works. And they consistently show up, like Finland, over and over is the happiest country in the world when they do surveys of how the people actually feel. And the U.S. is, 15th or 14th or something like that. We're not especially happy country. So unbridled capitalism, it isn't really capitalism anyway, because it's not really free market. There's monopolies and all kinds of government subsidies for oil companies and that kind of thing. So the goal of the tactics is to arrive at a country where people are happy and well cared for, like Scandinavia. And they don't have those problems of so many people anxious and depressed, and they're happier. The other tactic is that's used nowadays is, of course, hashtag activism. And some people criticize that and say, okay, then it's just clicktivism. So I signed a petition on moveon.org, so I'm done. No. For example, the Parkland students who are lobbying for gun control, their tactics were big social media use. I get emails from them all the time asking for money. And other tactics they used were being in the face of politicians. They confronted the Florida senators in debates after the shooting at their school, and confronted them in terms of their connection with the American Rifle Association, called them on it. So they've done a lot of investigative work and publicity about the corruption in the ARA. And I think that's made an impact. So they do traditional tactics of lobbying your politician. And what former staffers of Congress people said, what really works is you got to focus on your congressperson. Don't be thinking you can influence too much someone in another state or area. They care about your vote because your vote has count. So they emphasize lobbying your congressperson, going after the bad guys with publicity about their corruption, of course, demonstrations, rallies, visiting the White House. So in some ways, the tactics aren't that new, but they're just, I would say, older and more use of social media. And they're not afraid as young people to challenge authority, which is kind of interesting, because some of the older civil rights leaders criticized young Black Lives Matter leaders for not dressing properly, you know, having low slung pants, being vulgar, swearing, cussing, you know, having rap music as part of their scene with swearing. So I think the tone has changed, that young people are more impatient and they're more willing to stand up to authority and not be so cowed to it I don't think they respect authority because the world is so messed up. Whereas earlier generations, even of civil rights leaders, were more respectful of elders and authority and that kind of thing. They're not, because we mess things up.
Yes, and wanted to sort of ask on the what are tactics that you found people are avoiding at this point?
Well, you know, we haven't had any of those long-term tent city occupations, which I think is interesting. Mm-hmm. They kind of died out. I'm trying to think. Another tactic that young people use that is, I think, fairly new is humor and joking and having fun.
Maybe even satire.
Yeah, satire. For example, one of the early youth-led revolutionary movements was in Serbia, and a group called OTPOR, I don't know how you pronounce it, OTPOR, in 2000, they did things like they had a barrel with a picture of the dictator on the outside of the barrel, and you could put in money and beat the barrel as it rolled down the street. So I think the kind of use of, as you say, satire, joking, humor, poking fun at people is new. And another tactic that's new that civil rights leaders have pointed out, like Angela Davis, is it used to be like verboten to talk about your personal needs for self-care or your mental health status or that kind of thing. But among young people, and Angela Davis has called this out, then they recognize, oh yeah, it's okay to say I'm totally burned out. I need to take a break for a month or whatever it is. Or, you know, I'm suffering from anxiety and I need some support from the group, or I need to talk about it or whatever. So that's those new tactics: humor, joking, satire. What they're not using that youth did until recently was the tent cities. And I'm not sure why. Maybe because it invites police confrontation. So it's easier to kind
yes,
of...
Yes, right. Well, in these days, tent cities are easily confused with
homeless
issues. So I can see where people don't want to be rousted as if they were homeless people, because we know how our cities handle that group. I want to get kind of your personal take. You've been working on this a long time. What is your sense of optimism or pessimism that the current group of young people, at whatever age you want to discuss, can and will make a difference and really will transform the world that they're going to inherit from us, we who've screwed it up?
The Pew Research Institute has done a lot of good survey work, and Harvard also has an institute that surveys youth political attitudes. And all those study surveys find is that young people, Gen Y, Gen Z, are more liberal. So people who are friends of mine who are worried about the rise of the Trumpians and the evangelicals who are behind Trump, even though he's immoral and a liar and whatever else, that these young people are liberals. So as they get older and more of them vote, I think they won't vote for the people who are don't understand the Constitution and don't understand separation of power and who actually believe in democracy. And then personally, my grandson is 11, and what I see with his peers is they don't think in terms of color, gender, class distinctions. They're very egalitarian, and they're used to women and girls in leadership positions, that kind of thing. They don't like labels. I try to get my grandson to say, okay, you are with this group of people, how would you identify them? Or how would you identify the other groups that eat together? And so we don't do labels. We don't like labels. No. So they're a really egalitarian generation. And also, this young people are a majority people of color. So they experience discrimination and inequality firsthand. So I am assuming they were going to be more interested in real democracy and egalitarianism. So I'm hopeful because of them.
Mm-hmm. We just have a couple minutes left, Gail Kimball. Where is your research taking you next? What are the next 20 books?
I just did a book on masculinity. I was interested in men's views about equality and mm-hmm. gender roles. So I did a book where I interviewed men who are involved in the men's movement or who had interesting perspectives. I did a recent book on happy marriages with long-term relationships because that interested me. And right now I'm interviewing young feminists from around the world for a book on young global feminists. So that, and all of these interviews are on my YouTube channel. Excellent. So if people are interested in a firsthand look, they can go to the YouTube channel.
I was about to go there. You've got also a webpage, a list of 21st century uprisings. You've got your YouTube channel. You do articles on WordPress. Any other resources that you can share with our listeners this morning?
People can always email me, gkimball@csuchico.edu. And I do a monthly radio show for KZFR, as you mentioned at the beginning, called Ask Dr. Gale, the second Thursday of each month from 6 to 7. So if people have topics they want to mm-hmm. discuss, they can email me and let me know what they'd like to explore.
My guest has been Gail Kimball. Thank you, Gail, for being on the Peace and Justice and Social Justice program this morning. Remarkable activist. You go off in numerous directions, and I'm really enthusiastic about your work. Grateful that you are part of our Chico community. So thank you, Gail,
thank
for
you.
Being with us today. This is the Peace and Social Justice Hour on FM 90.1, KZFR, Chico. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm Stephen Schutte. I'm sitting in for Chris Nelson on this edition of the show. The Peace and Social Justice Hour is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by BCAC.TV, Butte County's public access TV station broadcasting on Comcast Channel 11. BCAC-TV provides arts, entertainment, and information programming, including daily broadcasts of Democracy Now! They're on weekdays at 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. That is, Democracy Now! Is. Quote, things are changing at Comcast Channel 11. For more information or to get involved, visit bcac.tv. And we are supported by the Bankruptcy Law Offices of Michael O. Hayes, a proud supporter of community radio. Michael O. Hayes offers complimentary consultations and payment plans for Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. For more information, visit Chico
Chicobek, CHICOBK.com, or give them a call at 530-892-8916. In this second full hour of the Peace and Social Justice Program, I'll be talking with Pamina Furchow of Brandeis University, Tiffany Ferry of King's College London, about their work helping people in Colombia see and photograph examples of peace and justice in their communities. This was a pre-record that I did about 24 hours ago, and I think it's a pretty exciting interview to listen to. This is the Peace and Social Justice Program on KZFR. I recently read in The Conversation about a fascinating project in Colombia where everyday community members are used photography to document what they see as everyday peace indicators. The two project organizers are with us today via Zoom pre-record. Dr. Pamina Furchow is associate professor. She's in the Conflict Resolution and Coexistence Program at Brandeis University. Her research interests include political violence, transitional justice, including victim reparations, reconciliation, and peace building. Before entering academia, she worked on the worldwide campaign to stop the spread of illicit small arms and light weapons. My second guest is Dr. Tiffany Ferry. She's a visual sociologist. She's based in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. She's a specialist in participatory visual methods and community photography histories, pedagogies, ethics, and impact. On the Peace and Justice show today. So listeners can recognize your voices. Perhaps you can tell us a little more about your research. We'll start with Pamina.
Great. Well, thanks for having me join this radio program. It's great to be here with you. My name is Pamina Furchow, and Stephen did a great introduction. So I'm happy to also talk a little bit about the Everyday Peace Indicators portion, and then let Tiffany introduce herself and have her talk a little bit about Photo Voice and the photography element of our project work in Colombia. Mm-hmm. So Everyday Peace Indicators is a project that works with communities to generate community bottom-up indicators of peace, or really any difficult-to-define social concept. So we also do this for other concepts like justice, reconciliation, coexistence are a few. Essentially, the idea behind it is that whenever you measure anything, someone needs to make decisions about what the tools are and what the measurement tools are, the indicators essentially, for the measurement of these social concepts. And usually those decisions are made by outsiders. So they're made by experts, or they're made by maybe program managers in a project, for example, or by a country, people who are in a country and are part of the elite or part of the government. But rarely are those indicators created by the community members themselves. And so what we do is work with the communities to generate those indicators. And we have a multiple step process that we've developed over the last 10 years. We've been running since about 2011, 2012. And we've developed this process, this methodology, and really vetted it in a variety of different contexts. We work at the very community level, so the village or the neighborhood level. But we've worked in many different countries, including Colombia, but also in sub-Saharan Africa, in Uganda, South Africa. We're working in Sri Lanka. We also have a project now in Bosnia and Mostar, and we have one in California as well. So we're working generating these bottom-up participatory indicators in multiple communities worldwide. And although the process is very telling and really allows us to look at the indicators and use the indicators to analyze and understand how communities conceptualize things like peace or justice, it doesn't always include the most participatory or maybe engaging process, right? Community members are participating with us and they're giving us information, but the process can be extractive, especially when we're visiting multiple communities and generating these indicators with the communities and moving on to the next community quickly thereafter. And so we really wanted to use the tool in a way that was a little bit more interactive, and that also gave communities more information and let them interact with their own indicators. And we found that Photo Voice really complemented everyday peace indicators in a way that gave us all of that rich detail and information, and also that engagement that was lacking in that extractive kind of fast-paced process that we usually undertake when we're collecting indicators in multiple contexts. So I'll let Tiffany, or do you want to follow up with a question?
I just wanted to say I want to come back to the indicators in a little bit and learn a little bit about the range of them and specifically how you assimilate the data. But let's hear from Tiffany. You've been working with the Photo Voice Project for, I think it's 20 years. Tell us, please, about how that works.
Hi, Stephen. Many thanks for the invitation. And building on what Pamina has said, I'm sure many who are familiar with some of the thinking around participatory search methods knows that participation comes in many different forms. And within the kind of spectrum of participatory research methods, Photo Voice is really an action research method where community members use photography, so they use cameras and they take photos within their community in response to particular kind of research themes or community questions or concerns. So they're using photography to identify, define, and then also share issues that are important to them. So it's really very similar to the Everyday Peace Indicators methods. It's really about providing community members with a facilitated method and then also a platform to get their voices heard, to raise their voices. Photo Voice was first pioneered by a Canadian health researcher called Caroline Wang, and has actually been used in all sorts of different fields and disciplines and since it was first kind of pioneered in the 1990s. And no one Photo Voice project looks similar. It's a highly flexible method that can be done in all sorts of ways. But what we've been doing working with Photo Voice within Everyday Peace Indicators is looking at specifically how Photo Voice could be integrated to support and further amplify the Everyday Peace Indicators approach. So what happens and what we've been working with communities in Colombia on is once the Everyday Peace Indicators process has happened in a community. So once a community has identified lists of key everyday peace, justice and coexistence indicators, we come in and run photography workshops. It's an open invitation for anyone wants to join. We gather a group of community members who are interested in exploring the indicators further and who are interested in using photography. Start learning to use the camera. We do some visual literacy work and some basic photographic training, but it's really much more about, rather than learning about photography as a kind of technical form, it's really much more about community members working with the camera so that they can tell the stories that they think are important, that they want people within and outside of the community to hear. So they take some of these indicators, and both individually and then collectively as a group, they develop photo stories around these everyday peace indicators that have been developed by their community as a whole. And it's the idea is really for the community themselves to kind of drive and drill into and kind of open up what the significance of some of the specific indicators. Once they've created these photo stories, we create big public exhibitions that are hung all over their villages. And these exhibitions become important community events. And they allow really for the community, I guess, to celebrate themselves, achievements that are being made within the community as the community are working towards peace, because we're often working in quite fragile communities where peace isn't necessarily, peace process is still very much in process. So it's really about supporting and strengthening those everyday peace-building processes. The photography allows the community members to talk about the issues that are important. And what we've also found has happened on the back of the PhotoWisp projects is community members have decided to take specific actions in relation to some of the indicators that they have, which have been identified. So we could talk about that in a bit more detail, but I'll leave it for there so we can, you can ask any questions.
You also had mentioned that in Colombia has had essentially civil war and violence for a 50-year period. So many of your participants are responding in that context. I wondered if we could do a little visual radio. The article that I read included some of the photographs. There's one quite striking, children under a bed. There's another one of people holding hands. Their backs are to the camera. People of all ages holding hands, and one that was sort of one of my favorites, there's a duck standing in a muddy puddle in the street. I wonder if you could just describe one or several of the photographs that your participants created and then explain how that is an indicator of peace and justice.
Yeah, well, why don't we talk about one of the ones you mentioned, which is the children under the bed. Mm-hmm. So this is a picture of a couple of children kind of sheltering under a bed. If you just saw the picture, you might be quite, not necessarily understand what's going on. They look like they're playing a game. The indicator is actually talking about how, I haven't got the specific wording in front of me, so you have to excuse me if I misquote it. But it's something about children being able to play freely. Mm-hmm. And the story that the captions that go with the photos are really key because they kind of provide a context in the wider narrative about the story that the photographers are trying to tell. And in this particular instance, this young woman knew of a child who had been playing outside and had been accidentally shot. And the picture is referring to points in the kind of community experience, times when children are forced to hide under the bed to hide from gunfire because of fighting. And the caption is talking about how she hopes that in the future children will just be hiding under the bed because they're playing a game of hide and seek rather than to shelter from gunfire. So I think this kind of gives quite an evocative illustration of the kind of kind of very specific day-to-day, everyday priorities that they are for these communities. I could talk about another image, which is it shows a very overgrown cemetery. It's a kind of grave surrounded by bushes and wild grass. It's practically, yes. Mm-hmm. It's hardly visible. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen that one, but actually an indicator. Yeah, it was an indicator chosen by the group. So people, as individuals, chose indicators that they wanted to photograph, and then they chose a group one. And this indicator was about the the maintenance of the cemetery. So the village cemetery in San Jose de Orama, which is the community where that picture was taken, had become very overgrown. It was in a state of extreme disrepair, and this was an ongoing community concern, especially for the older members of the community that felt a lot of shame about the fact that their dead weren't being properly honored. And of course, many of the people buried within the cemetery are victims of the conflict. So it kind of directly relates to the conflict experience in terms of so many lives have been lost. And there's a deep concern about how those lives are remembered and memorialized. This indicator and then the photo story picked up on something that had been a long-running community concern. And what actually happened is the group went and photographed the state of the cemetery. And what was remarkable is because this was a real concern of the older members of the group, but because the younger members of the group came along with them and really started photographing and analyzing the issue, they all came back and looked at their photos. And there was a group decision that really something needed to be done. And the younger people, I guess, being the ones who are more physically, got the more physical strength and energy, supported the elder ones. And as a community, they decided to call something called a convite, which is like a community work party. And over 2 days, the community came together. It involved about 80 people. They decided to clean up the cemetery. So it's a really quite an amazing example where you see that often photo voice projects aren't really just about the images themselves, but what happens around the image. So the kind of action that can come off the back of this process where people are looking again at their community and can inspire and shift perspectives and give people, I guess, the motivation to do something about things. The remarkable thing about that particular story as well is it directly facilitated some of the processes connected to the peace accords, because actually the older members of the community, many of the graves were unnamed and uncovered, and it directly related to a kind of official institution that was looking to try and find bodies of people who had been disappeared. Mm. So an official came as well, and part of that cleanup process of the cemetery also aided those processes. So, it just shows how, I guess, that when the community are given a space and a process to take ownership of the indicators themselves and drive change themselves, there's all sorts of things that can come off the back of that.
Yeah, remarkable. I mean, immediate payoff for this kind of research. And you also have a community display, so it has immediate impact on the rest of the community as people look at those indicators. Pamina, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about other indicators that you use in your project, and then we'll get a little sense of my curiosity as a former academic, and then how you synthesize this and make it credible research. And I'm not doubting the research. I must say I had grad students who did action research as well, so I'm well familiar with what some of my colleagues used to call soft research, but yours is clearly anything but soft. So I'm babbling on there. Pamina, some other examples of everyday indicators, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe I can start by saying that, I mean, by explaining a little bit about the use of the indicators. And I think Tiffany really illustrated well how the community can use the indicators and how processes like Photo Voice really help to engage the community to then also act on the indicators. And and that the indicators themselves can be useful for community action, because although obviously community members already know the issues that they're facing, oftentimes they don't have a process through which they can go in order to kind of organize and galvanize around issues. And so the everyday indicators process paired with Photo Voice really allows for that that kind of organization to happen, and then also for action from the community from the bottom up, essentially. But of course, there are other, they cannot act on many of the indicators. When we go into a community, we generally generate between 80 and 120 indicators. And that's a lot of indicators. And a lot of those indicators are not indicators like the examples that Tiffany gave, where they're indicators that maybe the community can't act on. So indicators that speak more to policymakers, both at a local level as well as a national level, changes that the community feels it needs in order to work towards reconciliation, or in order to feel a sense of justice, and those kinds of indicators really can be used for advocacy, right? They can be used to advocate, I mean, both for the community as well as for other actors, to advocate vis-a-vis local authorities as well as national policymakers to make changes in for that community and within that region. Another kind of level or kind of indicator that we often see and that we see is really actionable by another kind of actor are indicators that are related more to projects or planning can also be used, for example, monitoring and evaluation. So indicators that that relate to the planning of a project that an international organization or even a domestic organization might be able to implement. So that organization may not be able to respond to an issue that only a government can respond to, but they can maybe bring a jobs program to a community or build a new well or potentially clean the water in a specific area of that village, or fix a road. So those indicators are actionable by those actors, and can inform their programming, their planning, and can also be used. I mean, all of the indicators can also be used to track change over time, just like any indicator. The everyday indicators can be used to track change over time in surveys. So when you know when you use any indicator, you can change that indicator into a question, and then ask that question in a survey. At a baseline, midline, endline survey, longitudinally over time, to see how there may be improvements or deteriorations in different areas.
It might be obvious, but for example, water supply, clean water supply, what would the actual indicator be? How would it be turned into a question? And then who would take responsibility for taking direct action that would alleviate the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the indicators in front of me like Tiffany.
Right.
I remember, and I think it was from this same community, there was an indicator related to water and access to water, because there were issues with clean water for, in particular, for animals to drink. So mm-hmm. one of the indicators was they were particularly concerned about cows and cows having access to drinking water. And so the indicator was something like cows can drink at the, I don't remember the name of the of the water source, but can drink at the water source of the village. And that's usually the indicator, right? There isn't more to it. There is, of mm-hmm. course, a why, like, you know, why, what's the problem, et cetera. But that's the more of the qualitative context around it. The indicator is that the cows can drink at that specific particular water source. Mm-hmm. Then once again, I mean, this is participatory research, but
yes.
What we are doing is we are really trying to turn this participatory research into numbers. And so we're part of a broader field of participatory statistics. So our resulting data and analysis is often quantitative and not qualitative, which is unusual, I think, in participatory research circles, because most participatory research tends to be more qualitative, or at least it seems it's seen as more qualitative.
Right.
So we're really turning, you know, these people's understandings of these concepts into quantitative data. And we're doing that by both crunching numbers about how they perceive, so the indicators themselves. So we code the indicators into categories, and then we can also give information about what general areas are more important for a village. So if they, for example, prioritize issues related to security over maybe development or infrastructure, or perhaps they're very concerned about armed actors. We have these general categories and dimensions that we code into, and then we can say, well, there's a certain percentage of indicators in a certain category or dimension, and that allows us to then say more and have a kind of a more general understanding of where those indicators fall for a community. But it also allows us to compare one community to another. So, you know, if we do the process the same way in another 10 communities, you know, do all of them prioritize infrastructure-related issues over security-related issues? Or are there some that are more concerned with issues related to gender, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So we can quantify it that way. But then, of course, we can also quantify it, again, by using the surveys. So by tracking change longitudinally over time and gathering data using the indicators as questions in our surveys.
Very interesting. The way you have bridged the gap between participatory action research and little bit of number crunching there. I think clearly this is something that could be useful for a number of communities. I wonder if either and both of you could talk a little bit about where else you have done this project, either the Photo Voice project. Tiffany, you've been working on it for 20 years. Pamina, you mentioned several other countries, Sri Lanka, Africa. Tell us a little bit more about where else you've been, either or both of you.
Well, maybe I'll give Tiffany an opportunity to talk a little bit about the Photo Voice work that we're going to be doing in Mostar in Bosnia. Tiffany, do you want to briefly talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I can talk about that. It's always really hard. Later this year, we're going to be starting off as well integrating Photo Voice with the Everyday Peace Indicators in Mostar in Bosnia, which is going to be really exciting. And I'm sure we'll take a very, you know, kind of whole new form. We'll get a whole new learning about this integration of methods. I wonder if I could quickly speak as well to the point that you were kind of bringing up, Stephen, about, I guess, essentially rigor that you were talking about in relation to kind of participatory data and its validity. I mean, one thing that's so interesting, I think, about this kind of mixing of methods, different kinds of participatory methods, some that are more researcher controlled and others that are more community action driven, is that we can really attend to something that Robert Chambers, who's the kind of, you know, great pioneer of participatory methods, has called inclusive rigor. And I think it's something that's so essential to the peace building field, particularly at the moment where there's been a real kind of recognition of the failure, in a way, of the liberal peace building project to really properly listen to and respond to the needs of those communities who are directly affected by conflict. And what can happen when you mix very different kinds of methods? Because, you know, as Pamina has been explaining, essentially the everyday peace indicators produce is a participatory numbers and a participatory statistics process, whereas Photo Voice is a, you know, a visual, participatory visual and narrative process. They produce really different kinds of data, but they're very much complementing and amplifying each other. And in doing that, as a whole, they can speak to multiple forms of knowledge and how we know and what can be done with that knowledge. It can, we can be accountable to different audiences, which is what makes it so exciting. I have been working with Photo Voice for over 20 years, and I've worked on projects for over 10 years, projects that have run over 10 years to projects that have run for a couple of days in the UK and all over the world. But what often happens with Photo Voice is it can often happen slightly in isolation. And that, I think, really undermines its potential. The real strength of what can be done when you're looking to support kind of community level processes, I think the real power is in using and mixing methods that can to attend not only directly to the kind of community needs and priorities, but ensure that the community's voices are heard in other areas. And what the indicators method, that kind of participatory numbers and statistics, brings to Photo Voice is it kind of puts some weight behind the images and the narratives that are told. So these aren't just kind of plucked out of anywhere. These stories are based, have kind of been born of a process that has attended, consulted with the entire community and been validated for a particular process, and can also be represented in more kind of traditional, forms of social data, alongside the kind of indicators and participatory statistics data. So what I guess is exciting about this, and, we'll see as we get to develop it in more countries, as Pamina said, we're going to be integrating Photo Voice in Mostar. There it'll be quite different. We're working within a city rather than in rural communities, which is where we've been based. There'll be different kinds of issues. In Colombo, we had to be very mindful of some of the security issues because we were often working in communities where there was still some form of presence of armed actors. In Mostar, there'll be different kinds of issues because, of course, the conflict and the peace building context there is very different. So we'll have to come back to you and talk to you again when we understand more about how it all plays out in Bosnia.
Love to hear more about that. I wanted to ask Tiffany, I'm thinking I work with a local charter school, and I want to give the kids cameras and send them out to find maybe peace and justice or community indicators. I assume you've done that with younger, well, you did in Colombia. Do you have specific projects where you send kids out with to do Photo Voice?
Yeah, I mean, Photo Voice is often just done. It very much just depends how it's done. It's sometimes done as very much a research exercise where you work with a community that are kind of given, I guess, like a question that they go off and then photograph in response to. But other times it's been done much more as a kind of community empowerment process where photography is really being used to support the community themselves to define those questions. So there's a lot more work that's going on alongside the actual picture taking to look at those images, to understand what's going on in them, think about the story that those communities want to tell. So the actual picture taking is a very small part of the process. It's yes. Also what is happening around those, the dialogues that happen around the pictures, the how looking at pictures and discussing pictures and going out to take pictures. It's a kind of embodied process where what you're really looking to achieve, I guess, is support a community to reflect on its own concerns and then define and communicate them to others. So there's that kind of group process of deciding what you want to photograph, why you're photographing, what is it you want to tell about that particular issue. But then also it can be done as an exploratory exercise. So as you say, you know, handing out cameras, setting a group of young people with a task, and they go out and then reviewing those images, they explore that issue a bit more. They refine what it is they want to say, and then decide maybe how they might want to share what the conclusions that they've come to, or the stories that they've come up with, how they want mm-hmm. to share it with others. Because that's obviously the key part of Photo Voices, really, you know, what are those pictures for? Who do we want to speak to? What do we want to say? Is it just for us as a group to try and reflect on an issue together? Or is it maybe that we want to talk to others in our community, or, you know, as Pumina said, you know, we could, often Photo Voices used to talk to policymakers or people in positions of power who might have, who might be able to, yeah, make shifts in, who might be able to action change that can directly affect their lives. So, you know, images can be used in all sorts of ways. The great thing nowadays is, you know, we really are all photographers. The accessibility
yes. mm-hmm.
of photography. There isn't any really need to teach photography. Not that I don't think teaching photography is never really a part of Photo Voice, but people can go out, take pictures, have fun. But the conversations that can come out of looking at those pictures together, discussing the issues in them, can generate really kind of significant conversations that support a community to really think deeply about issues that are important to them, and potentially decide to do things off the back of those, that, you know, that process.
Yeah, and if I can just add, I mean, I think it also speaks to this question of rigor, right? I mean, it's really a spectrum. I think you can use participatory tools just to engage people in a in peace building work, right? To get them thinking, to get them out into the community, to get them engaging others. But as a research tool, there's also, I think, a spectrum of rigor as well. As Tiffany said, the Photo Voice tool can be used in multiple ways, and so can everyday peace indicators. And I think the one of the main rigor questions in participatory research is, you know, if we're going to be making claims about the results of the research, who are we talking about and who have we included in the research, yes. right? Mm-hmm. And so, so if we're saying these are everyday peace indicators, well, and we're saying these are the community's everyday peace indicators, who is the community, who has participated, who is engaged, how rigorous have we been about ensuring that that they are really representative and inclusive of multiple voices within that community. So I think it's also, you know, it's also a question of rigor of what you want to do with the results of what you produce using that mm-hmm. participatory research.
I hope I didn't overemphasize the idea of rigor, because I'm totally personally supportive of the kind of research that you're doing. We're about out of our time, and Tiffany is off to catch a train or a bus or something shortly. I just wanted to close briefly with a quote. We also found, you wrote, that combining photography with our everyday peace indicator approach amplifies local voices, illuminating what policymakers and international donors often miss about what matters to the everyday lives of the community members they support, which seems to me crucial in the kind of research you're doing. I want to thank you for being on the Peace and Social Justice program today. My guests have been Pumina Firchow from Brandeis University, Tiffany Ferry from the King's College London. Thank you both for being on the Peace and Justice program with me today.
Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen, for having us. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Peace and Social Justice Hour on KZFR. My name is Stephen Schutte. I've been sitting in for Chris Nelson. The Peace and Social Justice program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Chico News and Review, hosting the best of Chico. Vote for your favorite Chico businesses by logging into newsreview.com/Best of Chico. The June issue features local history, the drought, wildfire recovery, and more. Chico News and Review, your local source for news and entertainment with locations throughout Butte County, and they're online at chiconewsreview.com. And we're supported by Baker's Birkenstock, featuring more than 40 brands of footwear, socks, purses, and hats. Baker's Birkenstock has been serving our community for over 40 years with locations at 333 Broadway Street in downtown Chico and at 691 Fir Street in Paradise. They're also on Facebook. Remind you, coming up at 1 o'clock today, it's Playing Dead, and at 3 o'clock, it's Devastation Sounds of Reggae.
Lately, I've been feeling really empty inside and had no motivation. It's all in my head, it's all in my head, it's all in my head.
Hey, Shannon, I've noticed you've been feeling down and depressed, but it's not all in your head. What you're going through is a serious issue and you aren't alone. Suicide has been the second leading cause of death from ages 10 to 34. I know it's hard to get help, but there are people out there that care about you and are experiencing the same thing. If you're experiencing depression, please don't hesitate to call the Suicide Prevention Hotline, 1-800-273-8255.
This message is brought to you by Pleasant Valley High School's House of Blue Media Program.
About the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again. Now I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Come on, the peace train. It's peace train, holy roller. Good friends too, because it's getting nearer, it soon will be with you. Come and join the living, it's not so far from you, and it's getting nearer, soon it will all be true. Oh, peace train sounding loud. Crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
rolling.
Everyone jump up on the peace train.
Come on, peace train. Hey, yes, it's the peace train.